Hello, and welcome to Ask an Atheist, a weekly educational program dedicated to atheism, skeptical inquiry, and the separation of church and state. We air live from Scan Studios in Seattle every Sunday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, and are archived online at www.askanatheist.tv. My name is Sam Mulvey, and with me today is Libby Mistretta. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Sam?
Oh, pretty good. Are we ready for this?
I think we're ready for this.
Okay.
We're totally ready for this.
Totally ready for
it's
this.
It's going to be a good episode, and you know why? Because it's the first episode of season two.
Season two.
We made it. Here, high five.
High five.
We made it through season one.
Had I known a year ago that we would be talking about season two of this show right now,
that's pretty
exciting.
I would
have told you to get out of here.
Get out of here. Oh, is that another one? That was a fist bump.
Yeah. Terrorist fist bump or whatever it's called.
Oh, God.
Oh, man.
So we have some pretty fun announcements after that, completely out of nowhere. Thank you, Sam.
What? I'm hip in the media or something. I don't know.
Oh, my goodness. Before we launch into announcements, I personally want to give a shout out to the Gecko Demon who drew some really awesome fan art. I love the internet. Can I just say that?
It is my first piece of fan art ever.
Fan art of him and of Mike.
And of Mike.
No fan art of me. The Gecko Demon, I'm sad. I'm crying a little bit. Do you see the tear? Right there. Just throwing that out there. I was very impressed with it. I thought it was great.
It's been the talk of the show for today. And we are, next time me and Mike are on the show, we're definitely going to use it. So
oh, yeah.
Thank you for
that. It was
that.
A good one. Yes, thank you. We appreciate all our fans. They're awesome. Anyway, announcements. Very important, serious announcement that we really need to get out here. Scan TV, which is the studio from which we broadcast live every Sunday, is facing some budget cuts as the city of Seattle is preparing their new budget for the upcoming year. And Scan is unfortunately facing some cuts that will really impact how we're able to bring the show to you, our viewers. So
if you're subscribed to the podcast or watch the show on the internet, we actually cut into the beginning of the first beginning episode of the last episode,
right?
With an announcement. And the short form is that instead of refunding Scan for this year, they're actually cutting it to about 1/6 of Scan's usual funds and then putting it out for bid.
Right.
So
that could really, that could seriously affect how we're able to bring this program to you. We want to do everything we can to prevent that from happening. So if you are interested in keeping our show going and all the other shows at Scan, which I hope you would be because there's some really fun programs, we hope you go to scantv.org, read up there on how you can possibly help affect the future of Scan and take some action.
Rather than just emailing Scan, there's a list of all of the people on the city council who are involved who should be contacted about the future of Scan. It's especially helpful if you are a Seattle resident, but even if you're not a Seattle resident, this is good press for Seattle. The fact that this show is being produced here and people pay attention to us gives people the opportunity. It basically, you know, it helps Seattle out to have people know that we're here.
Yes.
Especially since we're talking about what nationwide we consider to be 15% of the population is probably atheist, and in the Pacific Northwest, that's actually the percentage is considered higher. So people in Seattle and people outside of Seattle do need to let the city council know that Scan is paid attention to, people pay attention to the show, and it has a positive effect on the municipality.
And please, if you are, and we hope that you will write some letters to the city board members who are going to be approving the budget, please keep it professional, keep it positive. We don't, you know, want to hurl any abuses, obviously. Yeah. Not that any of you would ever consider doing that.
No trolling.
Of course. Of course. And another really fun announcement, speaking of Scan and how much we love it, we have reruns now!
Yeah!
We have reruns of Ask an Atheist!
Who knew?
I'm so excited. Every Monday at 6 p.m. on Scan TV, we have reruns. So I can't tell you how excited I am to be a part of a show that not only is on TV, but has reruns.
Which means I actually get to sit in my house and watch us do the show.
I know, because I've never gotten to see us do the show.
Yeah,
I'm always here.
I've only gotten to see it when we ran the reruns instead of our normal show.
Right.
But now I get to watch the show like everybody else is. It's going to be a new experience. I think it's going to improve the show.
Yes, although obviously it kind of goes without saying, but the reruns, you can't call in and talk to us.
Unfortunately.
We're not here. That's the magic of TV.
In that situation, if you catch the rerun, the number to call would be the voicemail line. And we think we have that up, but we'll talk about that a bit later. But if you do have, if you would like to talk to us now, this is a live call-in show. And we had the number up a minute ago. It's 206-421-5658, I believe. Yes. Again, 206-421-5658. If you'd like to talk to us, please call in.
Indeed.
And
that's yours.
Oh, that is mine. Okay. Well, we usually do this. We do want to let people know about the sort of organizations that exist in the Seattle area and the greater Puget Sound area, and even places in Washington or Oregon or whatnot. If you want to talk, if you want us to give a shout out for the announcement or an announcement for your free thought group, give us a call or leave us a voicemail. Give us send us an email at askanatheist.tv, and we'll give a shout out to you on the air and let people know what's going on. We often have announcements for Seattle Atheists, for various media groups in the area.
Yeah.
Especially the one out in Cashmere, Washington. We did.
Yeah.
We did do one shout out for them, and I said a few months ago that I or about a month ago that I would try to make it to one of those meetups, even though it's a bit out there for me. I still plan on it. So I'm on that meetup.
At some
and I'm
point,
keeping track of it. So.
We'll road trip out there. Anyway, I think it's time to launch into our mystical spate of news articles.
It's a fun one this week.
Before the dawn of time, a race of druids. Nobody knew who they were or what they were doing.
Right to it. This comes to us from the Toronto Sun. This is druidry, recognized as religion in Britain. Am I saying that right?
I think so.
Okay.
It's kind of a tongue twister.
It is. The ancient neo-pagan religion, best known for Stonehenge, has been recognized as a religion and has been given charitable status in Britain. The decision was made by the Charity Commission for England and Wales on Saturday, after a 4-year-long application process brought forth by the Druid Network. The 21-page final report released by the commission states that the board members concluded that the Druid Network is established for exclusively charitable purposes for the advancement of religion for the public benefit. Both the Charity Commission and the Druid Network sound like mid-season television replacements. I would watch those shows. The Charity Commission, they travel the world. They airdrop people in to do charity.
They sound like part of the Illuminati to me. Actually, now you can probably hear the laughter in the background. It would be a good time to mention we do have a live studio audience today.
Yeah.
So thanks for coming out, guys.
Hi, guys.
you might hear them from time to time because I don't think we're going to be able to get through any part of this episode without laughing a little bit.
Oh,
it's going to be interesting.
But, it's nice to... If druidry would be... Druidry. I feel like I'm in Spaceballs. If that would be recognized anywhere, I think Britain would be the place it'd be recognized.
That's the place to do it.
And there's a lot of religious
Druidation? Sorry, our floor director just held up a sign that said, Druidation? Question mark? Yeah,
is that the process of becoming a druid? Druidation?
Druidization?
Druidization. To be druidized.
Who knows?
But, congratulations for getting the funding in England to you druids out there.
Why not?
I know getting religious status in the UK is a little bit more difficult than it is here because of we actually have the anti-establishment clause, and England actually has a vestigial organ, actual state religion.
Yeah.
So, definitely congratulations are in order.
They worked hard for 4 years, apparently.
Four years, 21-page final report from the Charity Commission. Anyway.
Plus, of like 2,000 years ago or whatever, they built Stonehenge, so good on them.
I guess it's a decision 4,000 years or so in the making.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Okay, I have a news article. This is actually pretty popular when a lot of people sent this to us.
Yeah.
So we thank all of you for sending in articles all the time.
If you do have news stories, you can send those in to us, and we will definitely thank you. And we use the news stories. We love doing the news stories.
Oh, yes. They're always fun. So anyway, our news story here, basic religion test stumps many Americans. And I'll just read some excerpts from this article because I find it really interesting. And this particular, there are a lot of articles written about this Pew study that was just concluded, but this particular article is by Lori Goodstein of the New York Times. So Americans are by all measures a deeply religious people, but they are also deeply ignorant about religion. researchers from the Independent, the Independent Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life phoned more than 3,400 Americans and asked them 32 questions about the Bible, Christianity, and other world religions, famous religious figures, and the constitutional principles governing religion in public life. And on average, people who took the survey answered half of the questions incorrectly, and many flubbed even questions about their own faith. Hmm. Those who scored the highest were atheists and agnostics. Fist bump.
And the explosion.
as well as two religious minorities, Jews and Mormons. Which we'll touch on later.
I didn't know that about the Mormons. That's interesting to know.
Sam, yeah. There's a lot you don't know about the Mormons.
Oh, there's tons. The stuff I don't know about Mormons could fill a reasonably large bucket.
Or an episode of Ask an Atheist. The results were the same even after the researchers controlled for other factors like age and racial differences. That finding might surprise some, but not David Silverman, president of American Atheists, an advocacy group for non-believers that was founded by Madeline Murray O'Hare. Silverman says, I've heard many times that atheists know more about religion than religious people. Atheism is an effect of that knowledge, not a lack of knowledge. I gave a Bible to my daughter. That's how you make atheists. I think that's a great quote.
It worked for a lot of people I know, including myself in many ways.
Me too.
I was like, well, I'm kind of an agnostic. Then I read the Bible, so I'm definitely an agnostic. There's no question.
So the article goes on to say, researchers said that the questionnaire was designed to represent a breadth of knowledge about religion, but was not intended to be regarded as a list of the most essential facts about the subject. Most of the questions were easy, but a few were difficult enough to discern which respondents were highly knowledgeable. One finding that may grab the attention of policymakers is that most Americans wrongly believe that anything having to do with religion is prohibited in public schools. An overwhelming 89% of respondents asked whether public school teachers are permitted to lead a class in prayer correctly answered no. But fewer than one of four knew that a public school teacher is permitted to read from the Bible as an example of literature, and only about one-third knew that a public school teacher is permitted to offer a class comparing the world's religions.
That's interesting, since world religions is usually part of any social studies curriculum. Religion
is
discussed in schools.
At least touched on briefly.
And this goes back to episode 10 last season, when we discussed the Kitzmiller trial.
Yes.
And everybody, all the people on the side for co-design proponentsists were saying, well, they're banning religion from the schools. Religion, you can't talk about religion in schools. And that's not true. It's never been true.
Right.
And that, in fact, contravenes the separation of church and state rules. Is we can talk about religion in school. It's that the state cannot sanction religion in schools.
Right. So the article concludes here with a little shout out to clergy members who are concerned that their congregants know little about the essentials of their own faith. They will no doubt be appalled by some of the findings from the studies, such as 53% of Protestants could not identify Martin Luther as the man who started the Protestant Reformation, and 45% of Catholics did not know that their church teaches that the consecrated bread and wine in the Holy Communion are not merely symbols, but actually become the body and blood of Christ. And that is something also that I'll bring into our topic later. But
that's a little hard to take, let's be honest.
It is. It is. And it's something interesting that we'll talk about more as the show develops.
Well, the thing is, on that one, is it's interesting, since that atheists and Mormons and Jews are in minority positions, it makes sense in order for social defense.
Right.
We all sort of have to become armchair religious studies majors in order to actually adequately interface with religious people.
Yeah.
Is that we kind of have to know when they say something that, well, that's not necessarily from what I believe, but when they start talking like this, this stems from their beliefs.
Right.
And the other thing is I've noticed is they said if you want to make an atheist, have them read a Bible. Almost every religious studies major I've ever met, or somebody with a degree in religious studies, is agnostic. And it seems like the more you study religions in the theologian social sense, rather than, say, going to a Bible college, the more you realize some of the stranger things about religion and just the wide range of belief, and the less likely you are to be devout.
Yes.
I think there is, in this, a connection not between atheism and study, but agnosticism and study. That study does bring questions. And that brings me to our next story, which is related to the last one. This is from Daniel Dennett at the New York Times. And this is The Unbelievable Truth, Why America Has Become a Nation of Religious Know-Nothings. And the story begins like this. Or is this an opinion piece?
It's an opinion piece based on the Pew study. Yeah.
Okay. The new study by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life released this week shocked many with the revelation that atheists and agnostics tend to know more about the world's religions than believers do. Pew researchers asked more than 3,000 Americans, and we know about this, so I'll skip that, but moving on, the age of the Earth, the existence of billions of galaxies, the detailed confirmation of evolutionary biology, including our demonstrated close kinship to chimpanzees and indeed all other mammals, all of these discoveries and many more have taken their toll on any literal understanding of the holy texts. Scholarship about the history of these texts has also made it more and more obvious that they are imperfect human artifacts with a long history of revision and adjustment, not eternal and unchanging gifts from God. So what's a religion to do? There are two main tactics. Plan A. Treat the long, steady retreat into metaphor and mystery as a process of increasing wisdom and try to educate the congregation to the new sophisticated understandings. Plan B, cloak all doctrines in a convenient fog and then not just excuse the faithful from trying to penetrate the fog, but celebrate the policy of not looking too closely at anyone's creed, not even your own.
Interesting. So which of those two have most denominations taken, I wonder?
He goes on. Plan B has been the choice of most religions and denominations, and the result, not surprisingly, is that most religiously affiliated people have no firm knowledge or even opinions about the finer points of any religion, including their own. How, then, to explain the apparently contradictory fact that, according to Pew, atheists they surveyed knew the most about religion? Atheists tend to be those curious and truth-loving folks who do take a good hard look at religious professions of faith, and hence they tend to know what they are walking away from. There have always been atheists, though not always very visible to the public. Yeah, that's for those people who like to call us new atheists. That's for you.
Yep.
The fact the perennial nagging doubts of the few atheists in the crowd have probably been the main force of sustaining theology. And I talk about this. The whole branch of apologetics wasn't like some sort of religious demolition derby where all the religions go in an arena and fight. Is that the apologetics was designed to fight doubt.
Right.
And right there. And, so it goes on. So the Pew results are no doubt actually somewhat stronger than they first appear. The more you know about religions, the less likely you are to believe religious creeds and myths, and thus the more likely you are to be an atheist or agnostic, whether or not you are affiliated with or even clergy in a church. And I do want to say something about the Pew Research thing. Is every once in a while one of these survey people is we discuss this about surveys and polling people is every once in a while you get one of those studies about like American knowledge and stuff like that, and they say, well, 5 out of 10 Americans believe the sun revolves around the Earth.
Right.
And I tend to think, I have a theory that a lot of those are gamed. Like if I'm walking in a mall or I get a random phone call and somebody says, hey, does the Earth revolve around the sun or does the sun revolve around the Earth? I can be kind of a jackass at times. I go, yeah, sun revolves around the Earth, sure.
Yeah, it's a possibility.
And I think there's a wider margin for that than one might expect. But in religious belief or the lack of religious belief is something closely held in America, and it has always been. This is where the new atheism thing comes from, is that we have always closely held our interest in skepticism, our interest in keeping questions when there isn't evidence for the answer. And just nowadays we're willing to talk about it. So on this one, I don't think that applies. I really believe the answers this gives us.
I think so. I think it seems like a pretty straightforward and trustworthy study.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think we're going to jump right into the episode here.
Okay.
I had another article to read, but we'll save it for another episode because I'm so eager to get into this one. So I revealed on the very first episode of Ask an Atheist when I was co-hosting with Mike that I was raised in a Mormon family and considered myself a Mormon for a long time. And I was approached by some members of the crew about doing an episode on Mormonism, and I said, okay, sure. And then I thought about it, and I was like, what, just talk about Mormons? That's not really that exciting. So I decided instead to kind of use some examples of how the Mormon religion has changed from its inception, which was around 200 years ago, to modern day times. as a way of examining and pointing out how basically all religions change as they evolve in response to pressures from the secular community and from the majority religious community that they're sort of ensconced within in the case of smaller religions like Mormonism. So we're going to get a quick crash course on what the Latter-day Saints Church is, for those of you who are not familiar. And then we will go and take a look at how some things have changed from the beginning of the Mormon religion to 2010.
I believe we have sort of a crash course.
Well, let me see if I can outline it for you first, basically.
Okay.
The official name of the church is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And Mormon, Latter-day Saint, or LDS can be used interchangeably, so that's something to keep in mind. We might use any of those terms as we go along here. I would say that some theologians, and certainly all Mormons, consider themselves to be Christians, that Mormonism is a branch of Christianity. Other branches of Christianity usually don't agree with that assessment and consider Mormons to be, like, way out there and therefore not part of Christianity. So I'll just leave it up to you, the viewer, to decide what you think about that.
That goes back to the differences between somebody who has a degree in theology.
Yes.
And somebody who went to
a Bible college. Exactly. So it's splitting hairs, basically, for the purposes of our show. So I won't go into it too much. I'll just say
I will say there is wide-held belief, even among some of the people in this room, about whether or not Mormonism counts as Christianity.
Sure, yeah.
We tend to believe it does.
Yeah,
I tend to look at religions in the same way that we look at speciation at this point. And, we've gotten rid of kingdoms. Is that we've really begun to realize that evolution and speciation is a process, and there is no clearly defined lines between different species. And I basically take that thinking and apply it to religion. And when I apply it to religion, it becomes clear to me that it's basically a branch of Christianity.
Essentially. That's how I feel, too. But I'm not going to argue over it. Whatever. For the purposes of the episode, it doesn't really matter that much. I will just say that Mormons do believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, that he died to atone for human sins, and that he was resurrected on the third day after his death, and that the only way to achieve salvation is to follow the teachings of Jesus. Pretty standard Christian beliefs. So we'll just go with that, and just so you know. There were, of course, some embellishments made by the early LDS Church to the standard Christian story, and some additions. But really, as you were saying before, I think we have a video clip that can explain this better than I ever could. So let's go ahead and roll the clip.
Yeah, short form history here.
Mormon Jesus. Mormon Jesus. Mormon Jesus. Long Jesus, long ago, a spirit child on one of these planets was conceived. Through an unidentified God, his God is why named Elohim. Elohim was conceived. This spirit child was later born to human parents near a mysterious star called Mormon Jesus. Mormons believed in Mormon Jesus. Through obedience to Mormon Jesus, he was elevated to godhood as Mormon Jesus. Mormon teaching and death, and Mormon Jesus, and endless saints, all life, the God of Mormonism and his wife produced billions of sons, Lucifer the devil, and a billion tons of children. The sons of the Mormon deep of a great heavenly meeting to decide their destiny, but to have sex with Elohim's eldest son, Lucifer, and his brother, Mormon Jesus. Elohim's son, Mormon Jesus, approved the proposal of the Mormon Jesus. Savior of the planet Earth would be Mormon Jesus. Early Mormon prophets Mormon taught Jesus. That Elohim, one of his wives, came to Adam to start to ride again. Have sex with a virgin in order to provide Mormon Jesus with the Indians. Mary Martha and Mary Magdalene. Of these wives, at least three wives, produced at least a billion Israelites. The Jesus of Mormonism, Mormon Jesus. Mormon Jesus. Joseph Smith. Mormon time.
So, ranked among things I thought I would never say, I really like God's come hither look in that video I saw.
He's gonna get you.
I know.
Okay, I have to say, I found that video on YouTube and I love it. And I don't know who made it. I can't remember. It was just like saved on your hard drive, right?
Yeah, you loved it too. It was just on my hard drive.
So during the preparation for this show, we were trying to figure out who made it so we could give proper credit where credit is clearly due, because that was amazing.
Clearly.
I think we're just going to have to end up tracking down the maker of that video and crediting him on our website, on the blog, and everywhere else.
If you know who made it, or you made it yourself...
Oh, wait, do we have the name?
Do we have the name?
The floor director's getting it. Yay.
Oh, good. The thing is,
seriously.
The source material... I have also the source material video from that.
Oh, good.
It's this...
Igiulamm. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Igiulamm. Contact us.
Thank you,
with a
YouTube person. You were amazing.
Awesome.
Really, that was great.
I also have the source material video for it, and it comes from a series of cartoons of different minority Christian sects.
Yes.
And with these rotoscope cartoons explaining their weird theology and why you shouldn't believe it in deference to our own strange theology made of this particular church. It's
right.
Very strange, and it's weird to have them have this what seems like a pretty rational critique of a certain mythology followed up by, don't believe in that mythology, believe in brand X theology.
Yeah, I believe that God somehow... made a virgin pregnant, and she gave birth to a human child that became a man who was actually God, even though God was his father. And I mean, it's all nutty. Come on.
Also, it does look a little bit like Bakshi's Lord of the Rings.
It does a little bit. I was kind of getting. I mean, you could almost set that same thing to the greatest adventure. I mean, seriously.
Intercut between the two.
Oh wow. Anyway,
cool. And I think that has to do with rotoscoping.
Rotoscoping will cure all of society.
I don't know what it is, but it's an awesome word.
Okay.
I do know what.
So
it is.
In case you were not able to glean it from that fabulous music number, complete with Dancing Lucifer, which I loved, here is a brief, very brief history of the Latter-day Saints Church. It's a little less than 200 years old. It was founded in 1830, just after the Second Great Awakening movement.
We've had a few.
Yes.
There was one in the 1780s or 1790s that sort of went to the early 1800s, and there was a bit of a gap.
A little bit, yeah, and then it kind of picked up again. And basically what these Great Awakenings were, they were movements of revival meetings and sort of religious extremism that were essentially all founded on the idea that Jesus was coming back any second now. So they were basically these apocalyptic kind of movements where people would get really fired up about
a lot of these revival movements, well, literally, when you get rid of the singing and all the pomp and circumstance, it's a bunch of people sitting in tent going, Jesus is coming now.
Basically that was it
for 200 years.
So that was how apparently we just cracked up the booth. Sorry, guys. We didn't rehearse that or anything. That's how cool we are. So anyway, just to give you some context, that was sort of how the Mormon Church was founded. Other religious denominations sprang up out of the same movement, notably the Shakers and the Millerites, which became the Jehovah's Witnesses. So that kind of gives you an example of some of the denominations that were founded around the same time
and
the same place.
We thought about interviewing a Shaker, but we couldn't find any.
Anyway, founded by a man you are possibly familiar with if you are a fan of religious history of any kind, named Joseph Smith. He grew up in an agricultural family, a bunch of farmers, and helped supplement the family income from the time he was a very young man, like 13, 14 years old, by doing something that was actually very common among pretty much all people in New England during the time, treasure hunting.
It does need to be said that in the time that he existed, working on the farm at 14 and doing treasure hunting on the side,
not unusual.
By no means makes him an unusual person.
No. That was what everyone did. And seriously, I mean, he had a pretty standard New England 1820s life. He worked on a farm with his family, helped supplement the entire family's income with his efforts, and definitely believed in folk magic of a sort, which basically everyone in the area believed in. And he made some pretty good money as a treasure hunter. He specifically was after precious metals like gold and copper. And he claimed to use two seer stones to help him find the treasures. Now, again, I cannot stress enough, because I know it sounds weird that this religion was founded by, like, a treasure hunter, and I guess in some ways it kind of is. That was a common thing in that place.
Hey, if he lived
place.
Today, he'd be on the History Channel.
Yeah, I mean... yeah, he would. He'd have his own show. He'd be, like, Bear Grylls or something, okay? So, but anyway, he did use two seer stones to help find his treasures, and yes, the South Park episode was correct. In order to use the mystical light from the seer stones, he put them inside a dark object, such as a sack, or his hat, stuck his face in it, and read the reflections from the stones, which told him where to go to find his treasures. Now, sounds goofy.
But
no
this
more.
Is the era of the snake oil salesman.
Yeah, it is.
The era of the traveling, the guy who would go around selling weird things to people that'll
yeah,
cure.
Yeah. Your... But it's no more goofy than water dowsing. It was basically what it was. He was using objects to tell him where in the earth what he sought was buried.
And when people talk about the weirdness of Mormonism, they start all the way back here. And again, at this point in time, this is not a particularly weird story.
No, you really, in order to understand how the Latter-day Saints Church picked up so much steam and got such a big following so quickly, it is important to understand, to put it into the proper context of time and place.
I do think he goes off the rails a little bit later, though.
Well, a little bit later, yes. fun fact about Joseph Smith that we may or may not get to touch on later, he was actually, at one point, as a punishment, tarred and feathered. I'm not kidding. They tarred and feathered him in Missouri, I think it was, or maybe Ohio.
Is that usually fatal in some way?
I don't know. I mean, it would definitely suck.
It's gonna hurt a little.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway,
it might sting.
In a region, namely the New England, it's gonna hurt come wintertime. In a region where there was a lot of religious upheaval, a lot, like really a lot.
To the point
the Second
where...
Great Awakening was crazy. And where most of the citizens believed in the power of the individual person to communicate directly with God, it was not at all uncommon for a person in that time and place to say, hey, I received a vision from God. That was something that happened to a lot of people, male and female. Nobody was going to think you were a loony toon if you were like, oh, I got a vision from God. They'd be like, oh, really?
Well, the Christian
revival... How are the crops doing?
The Christian revival movement was so strong in that period of time is that it kind of sucked all the religious weirdness out of the area.
Yeah.
And it eventually picked up a name called the Burned Over region.
Yes. They called it the Burned Over. They called this particular part of upstate New York especially, but a lot of New England was referred to as the Burned Over District because of all the hellfire and brimstone that was going through there. And like just religious furor that was everywhere. So that was F-U-R-O-R, not the German spelling that that indicates... Hitler.
Yeah.
Hitler has nothing to do with this. We're not invoking law.
Yeah, no Godwin law here.
Anywho, Joseph Smith was one of many, many residents of rural upstate New York who claimed that he had had important visions from God and or angels. When he was 15 years old, he claimed that God himself gave him a vision that all religions currently known to man were flawed in some way. They had gotten it wrong. And that the truly correct and complete version of God's holy church was going to be restored at some point in the future.
Except for that end bit. I tend to agree.
Yeah, okay.
Straight up.
All right, good times.
Most religions are flawed. Yeah,
we agree, yeah.
Okay, let's go. Oh, but I've got
We're with you on this.
I have brand X. Wait.
Yes. So anyway, he continued to receive visions, as a lot of people did. When he was about 18, Smith claimed that he was visited by an angel named Moroni. And this, if you've ever driven by or gone to a Mormon temple, which usually the architecture is really beautiful. They're nice temples. You see at the top of the steeple this little golden dude holding up a trumpet. That's Moroni, the angel.
And I would like to say that since, as in a callback to a previous episode, this was before H.L. Mencken.
Yes.
And his popularization of a certain word.
Yes. Moroni has nothing to do with the word moron, okay? Anyway, Moroni, the angel, allegedly told him that several mystical artifacts, including a set of better seer stones that were in the form of magic spectacles. See that? and a book of golden plates and some other objects were buried beneath a hill. Oh, plus five seer stones.
Plus five seer stones.
roll for seer stone bonus. We're being very irreverent. Sorry. I would like to apologize now to all my family members. I'm sorry.
And all of the people I'm going to be seeing in Arizona.
I love you guys, really.
Yeah, I really wish I had my dice back.
Anyway, most specifically, most importantly to our purposes, a book of golden plates along with these other objects were buried beneath a hill in upstate New York called Cumora. So, Smith...
Is that really a place, or is it...
I don't
know the geography of upstate
New York. Yeah, there is a hill that is known as the Hill of Cumora,
okay.
And that you can go visit it and be like, cool, golden plates. So apparently,
metal detector.
Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith made several attempts to remove the plates from the hill and the other treasures as well over the course of about 4 years, but claims he was prevented by Moroni because he hadn't met certain specific religious tests yet, one of which was to get married. I won't go into that. It's long and convoluted and has things to do with hermeticism, etc. Anyway, eventually he claimed that he did. He was able to remove the plates and the other treasures that he found in Cumorah, and he said he locked them up in a chest. Now, at the time, he was about 22 years old now, he had founded a treasure hunting company that was actually doing pretty kicking business in the New England region with some other guys. And because they were business partners, and Joseph Smith started saying, hey, I found these golden plates and these magic glasses and all this other great stuff. I've got them locked up in a chest. His business partners started to say, well, wait a minute, we're entitled to a cut of that because we're partners.
That's some serious money.
Right. Yeah. And now, for some reason, I'm not saying that the golden plates and the other treasure didn't exist, but for some reason Joseph Smith was reluctant to present them to his business partners. I believe he likely used the defense that, well, they're holy and sacred and nobody else can see them. So they started to get mad.
If they look at them, are they going to have Ark of the Covenant moment?
Like a melting face?
Yeah, and Raiders of the Lark.
That's possible. I don't know. I don't think so.
Again, to make an allusions to modern media, this treasure hunting company that he was a part of in the 19th century would be a lot like your modern ghost hunters.
Yes.
It's basically the same thing.
That's basically what they did. They were paid by people to come and scour, you know, land that was owned by a farmer or, you know, whoever, to use their dowsing materials, whatever they use, to find precious metal, precious stones, water, and other resources on people's land.
Really hammering the History Channel today, I am.
Yeah, I know. It is kind of, yeah. Mm. It's a History Channel kind of day. Anyway, Joseph Smith didn't want to produce his treasure and share it with his business partner, so he took off to Pennsylvania with his wife. While he was there, he began working on a translation of the golden plates he recovered from a language he called... He claimed that the plates were written in a language called Reformed Egyptian, and he was translating that into a book.
In the voice of Egypt, it's like the stripped-down Egyptian so that people worldwide can understand it. It's got... Is that how it works? Or
possibly.
Sort of like simple English?
I'm not really sure. Okay. Maybe instead of like African vultures for their hieroglyphs, they had like turkey vultures because it's North America.
Bird joke.
I'm a bird nerd.
Linguistic joke followed up by a bird joke.
Oh, the nerdery is painful here today.
Indeed.
So he translated the plates into a book known as the Book of Mormon. And he claimed that this was a missing chunk of the history of Jesus, as well as some amendments to the New Testament that had been goofed up just due to regular human error through translations over the centuries. So the missing history that is included in the Book of Mormon has Jesus' detour after his resurrection to North America, where he witnessed to the Native American people and then finally departed to heaven. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what the Book of Mormon contains. Eventually, he completed the translation.
It's
yes,
sort of like the director's cut of the Gospels?
Essentially, yeah.
Okay.
Good analogy. I like that. So, eventually, he completed the translation in 1830. And very shortly after that, because remember, we're dealing with the burned-over district where people are just, like, on fire for God, and they expect Jesus to come back right now.
Sometimes literally on fire. It was a weird time.
Sometimes. It was a really weird time. Mm-hmm. And worth studying. If you're a history buff, read about the burned-over district and the Second Great Awakening.
Now, we kind of glossed over this a little bit, but apparently he came to... we're going to get into this a bit later, but he came to the Americas to preach to people.
Jesus, you mean?
Yeah, Jesus. Yeah. And apparently there were Israelites or in...
Well, okay, it's kind of long and convoluted, but basically the Native Americans were from the tribes of Israel. They came over from Israel on a boat named Bountiful, I believe was the name of the boat, and they all set up shop here. And
that's like a pretty standard 19th century boat name, the Bountiful.
I know. And like, I mean, people riding a boat across the Atlantic during that time period, it seems a little improbable to me.
Well, there's some evidence that did happen on a couple of occasions, but it wasn't the kind of thing you're like, hey, family, let's get on the boat and go. So
right.
He left with 10 people, he arrived with 2.
Right, exactly.
Sort of.
So anyway, according to the Book of Mormon, the Native Americans are descendants of the tribes of Israel, and
branch of, I had a conversation with somebody about this, when I lived in Arizona, is that they actually have a whole branch of archaeology called Mormon archaeology.
Probably.
I've heard about this, and apparently they've got journals, and they publish, and it's peer-reviewed and stuff like that. But it's peer-reviewed, again, to make a call back to our show about intelligent design, it's peer-reviewed in sort of the same way that the intelligent design journals are peer
reviewed. Right.
They've changed the definition of peer to include member of an ideological group, so that
right.
in order to play in those particular reindeer games, y'all already kind of sort of have to believe.
Exactly. So it's peer reviewed.
Peer reviewed.
So anyway, Joseph Smith. So a whole bunch of people, you know, because we're dealing with a burned over district and everyone's really psyched about the second coming of Jesus, Mormonism very quickly started to pick up a big following. He had this book, after all, and no one else really did. Everyone else had to rely on, like, tent revivals and preaching in order to get their congregants to come in. So he had a book, which certainly seemed to give him more authority, I would think, than others. And he claimed himself the sole prophet of the church. And he probably, my guess is after reading a few history books, he probably claimed himself the sole prophet of the church in response to what some other early male members of the church were doing. They were claiming to have made some pretty, to
right.
have had some good revelations from God, too. So he kind of said, I'm the sole prophet.
That's straight out of the whole sort of the idea of the burned over district, is that people were regularly,
yeah.
Maybe God kept a summer home in upstate New York or something.
It could be.
Because the way it was showing up to people, every day somebody had something new to say.
Yeah.
And so if you got enough people behind you, in a religion, in a specific sect that you were building in the burned over district, eventually you'd have 6 or 8 or 50 other people saying,
yes.
Hey, I heard from your God too. And he says,
very quickly,
you're kind of a dork.
That was sort of the way it went. It was wild.
Yeah.
So anyway, as other members of this brand new Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, actually had a different name before that, but I can't remember what it is. It was something unified, whatever. They started to get their own visions, and Smith started to feel a little bit of pressure to be the guy in control of the church. So he kind of rounded everyone up and sent parties to Missouri and Ohio, where they were supposed to seek Zion, which was basically a Shangri-La type of. It was a city of perfection where everybody lived in harmony and no one sinned, and it was great. And the New Jerusalem, which was prophesied in the Book of Mormon. So apparently these were supposed to be in Ohio and Missouri, respectively, or somewhere thereabouts. But what the interesting effect is that as soon as these Mormons kind of left New York and went to Missouri and Ohio, the church basically doubled in size. So now they were looking at right around 2,000 members, which is a pretty good size.
That's pretty sizable.
And not surprisingly, people who made Missouri and Ohio their homes before the Mormons showed up were kind of concerned by this influx of what they perceived to be religious zealots with these weird beliefs that they kind of brought over from the burned over district where it was much more common to be all hellfire and brimstone and Jesus is coming right now. And that was not as much a part of the culture in these farming communities where the Mormons kind of took off to.
That did become part of the Midwest culture, but it became
yes.
part of the Midwest culture about 75 to 80 years later.
It took a little while before it kind of took root there. And up until then, they were just farmers doing their thing and going to church on Sundays and not thinking too much else about it. So the Mormons were a bit of a shock. There were some backlashes against them. There was mob violence in these small communities against Mormons.
There is some evidence that the violence was a little bit two-way.
Oh, yeah.
when you have stories like that, there's always one side has their side, the other side has their side. You know, we're going after the Mormons because they raided somebody or whatever, took somebody's land or stole sheep or whatever.
Oh yes, the Mormon people, the settlers were told to patiently bear the attacks up until the fourth attack, and then they would be able to attack back.
Yeah.
So they waited until they got jumped like 4 times, and then they had like a Mormon mob and went after the Ohio farmers or whatever.
I mean,
it was
mob.
Kind of madness. So eventually,
that's a high school gang waiting to happen.
Yeah, exactly. So soon the Mormons were persecuted enough that they started to break into these little factions within the church. And they would argue about points of scripture. This was only about 4 years after the Book of Mormon was actually published. So this was really early in the history of the church. I think actually at this point, I could be wrong about this, but at this point they weren't even called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They still had their original name.
It was a reasonably generic.
Yeah, it was
Christian
Union
name.
Of Christ. I don't remember. But anyway, the arguing among the factions became such a major crisis that Smith had to write another book, which he called The Doctrine and Covenants. And it altered some of his previous revelations from God from the Book of Mormon. and reflected changes in theology in accordance with what was going on in Ohio and Missouri in these communities where they had settled and experienced violence.
If I may quote the sainted Bill Hicks.
Yes, indeed.
A second book, correcting some of the stuff in the first book, sort of a God going, what I meant to say.
Right. Exactly. That's kind of what the DNC, that's what Mormons call the Doctrine and Covenants. It's the shorthand for
it. I would like to take this opportunity while we're getting closer to the end of the show, that this is a call-in show. If you'd like to discuss Mormonism with us or anything with us at all, shoes, food, beer.
I like to talk about shoes.
I like talking about beer. It's 206-421-5658.
Yes. So anyway, since the point of the Mormonism topic is how do religions change in response to pressure from their outside communities, just 4 years into the founding of Mormonism and already the book was basically being rewritten, the scripture was being rewritten to settle down the factions that were boiling up and to make greater peace with the community they found themselves in. So this began the church's track record of changing itself in response to the prevailing outside culture. And this is actually a lot more common in more mainstream faiths than most religious people realize. And
I think part of that is because historically, when we think about like the history, Western history, specifically the history of Europe, the culture was dominated by what eventually became the Catholic Church.
Yes. Is that
the Catholic Church set cultural doctrine. And when they set cultural doctrine like that, it's easy to think that religion dominates culture. But when you have sort of this pastiche of religions that you do in the United States, what you end up with, and this has been pervasive in the American Christian movements, is that there's this culture that the religions have to come to. Mm-hmm. And the religions are sort of have to conform to a relatively secular relatively secular culture. I mean, for a good portion of American history, the American culture was a Protestant culture, even
right.
though there were significant elements that weren't Protestant. But as you know, the 20th century advanced and now we're in the 21st century, it's become more and more secular, and the religions have to adapt to that.
Yes.
Rather than what they kind of wish they could do.
So like we saw in the articles about the Pew study that was done, a lot of Catholics, a majority of Catholics, at least the ones surveyed in the Pew study, didn't realize that the transubstantiation is intended to be literal. When the prayer is said over the wafers and the wine, they literally turn into the flesh and blood of Christ. It's not a metaphor, but possibly because we're so used to metaphors in our modern society, most Catholics take it to be a metaphor.
If there's a Catholic vegan who's watching this show,
I would really hear
an explanation of
me
that.
Me too.
Actually,
me too. So
and on like the nutrition. If we had nutrition facts for communion wafers, I mean the thing is when you really believe in transubstantiation, there are nutritional and medical questions that come into play. And
yes.
We actually have a call.
We have a call. We have Jimmy from Federal Way.
How you doing,
Jimmy? Jimmy, can you hear us?
How you doing?
Hey, pretty Jimmy, good. How's it going?
Yeah, I can hear you and see you too.
Oh, great.
I have a little delayed reaction here.
A little bit.
Yeah, you'll want to turn your TV down.
Turn it down. I think I better turn it off here.
Okay.
Yeah, now, what you ever thought about it? You know that your body has hormones in it, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
And when certain hormones are released into the bloodstream and get to the brain, and you have a reaction to these hormones.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what if God was a certain chemical in your body?
That's great. Why call it God? Why worship it? It's a chemical.
It's like why people worship heroin. Well, you know, it's the chemical that makes you feel good.
That's fine. I mean,
there is there is actually a branch of neurology out there that believes that there is essentially a religious region of the brain that when it's activated, it causes certain religious, sort of what we call religious ecstasy, triggers glossolalia, and causes people to have visions. There actually might be parts of the brain specifically devoted to that sort of thought.
Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking. That's the case because this thing can actually cause you to be healed if you can make it be released.
I doubt that it could actually cause physiological changes like that. It could cause a perception of feeling better, which is basically the placebo effect.
There is the placebo effect. There is the thing where in certain crisis situations, the endocrine system just dumps a lot of hormones into the system, and people are occasionally, do things they otherwise couldn't be able to do because they are so amped up on essentially brain drugs.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But coming off of heroin?
But it's always followed up, much like heroin, with a significant crash.
Yes.
When you have that sort of, when you get amped up like that, you always pay for it. It has significant physiological damage.
Mainly, though, Jimmy, my main point is, if we were to discover that everyone's experience of God, like every person who claims they have had a vision from God or have felt the presence of God or whatever, if that were to someday be explained by science as a chemical, great. That doesn't mean that God, a personal being in the sky or whatever, who's judging your sins,
yeah.
It doesn't exist. It's your brain.
I would say.
Yeah, I can see your point, but see, your brain, your body is a representation of the entire universe. Everything in your body can be found in the universe. So just like whatever.
Chemically,
you,
yes.
Carl Sagan would agree.
Yes. We are made of star stuff, as the Sagan-meister would say.
The Sagan-meister.
But anyway, yeah, I kind of agree with you. It could just be a chemical reaction, but if so, then why call it God?
I think if we were able to synthesize...
Because we don't know, there's not enough people who studied medicine and chemistry. That's all they know is something outside of them. That's all they've been taught. Even the Bible says, a lot of people die for lack of knowledge. They don't know
anything. Okay, I'm a little bit curious. Does this signify your belief?
See, I've been studying chemistry lately, and I go to church, and I read the Bible, and there's a lot of things in there about the laws in there, about just, there's so many laws. Well, you know God didn't say that. It was this man was using it. Said God said it, so he could have power over the people.
Right.
But then there are some things in there with your own life. You call on God, you pray, and things happen you don't believe. Now, why did that happen, man? Is that me? Is that my own power?
But what about
God,
all the times,
or is it both of us?
Jimmy, what about all the times when you pray for something and it doesn't happen? I mean, what you're experiencing is what we call confirmation bias. So sometimes you pray and you think, oh, I really want this to happen, and it happens. You're like, it happened because I prayed.
Like, for example.
But what about all the times when you pray and it doesn't happen?
One of our producers, Casey Dorn.
Well, prayer is that you get into prayer is just electrical signals being sent out.
Here's the thing. If there is a chemical which causes us to have religious experiences, for me, that would be proof against God.
Right.
Because if we can synthesize a chemical and give them... God is a chemical? Well, Philip K.
I'm not going to call that God. I mean, let's call that what it
is.
It'll, like,
it God. Just,
it'll be some kind of
the
like
name
chemical
that has
name.
Been assigned to
God-ing.
This phenomenon.
God
that's the name
God
that has been assigned to the phenomena.
Well, now we're just redefining God.
You
God
can't, words have meanings. Words have meanings. You can't. When you say the word God to somebody on the street, they have a picture in their mind of a specific type of definition,
taught.
And it doesn't include hormones in your brain. So,
because they have been taught that. If you can...
But that's what the word is. That's the way language works. You know, that's how our language evolves itself.
If God becomes a chemical, if the concept that the word God defines becomes a chemical reaction in the mind, God ceases being the God of the Bible. God ceases being the God of the Quran.
Right.
And
it becomes something else.
And the question of whether or not I believe in God essentially becomes academic because I'm no longer speaking about the supernatural, but I'm speaking about a chemical process.
Right.
Chemical process that God created.
Yeah, well, see, there's a... That's sort of a tautology, and
yeah,
unfortunately,
it is. Because, and we got to get going, Jimmy.
We're getting towards the end
have
of the show.
We have to finish up our.
I know.
Our topic, but was really cool talking to you.
Something to think about. You do have a spot in your head for it. Okay.
Thanks
right,
a lot,
thank
Jimmy.
You.
We
right,
appreciate
bye.
It. Bye bye. So anyway, we only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to rip through a couple of examples of how the Mormon Church has changed in response to secular pressures. For some food for thought to leave you with, and then we'll go on our merry way. So we all know, probably most people who are familiar with Mormons know that they are famous for their eschewing strong drinks, which they traditionally take to include not only alcohol, as you might assume, but also anything with caffeine in it.
I tend to think that if the other religions that eschew alcohol, like the Muslims, actually knew of the existence of caffeine or had it synthesized the way we did,
they might eschew it too,
because, man, caffeine has some weird effects. I'm feeling
I got to
right
move
now.
On here, buddy, because we got to get through like a few more before the show's over. So anyway, something that a lot of people don't know is that in the strong drinks thing is in the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, hey, don't drink strong drinks. There's a line of scripture immediately following that one that actually says, yea, flesh also of beasts and of the fowls of the air, I, the Lord, have ordained for the use of man with thanksgiving. Nevertheless, they are to be used sparingly, and it is pleasing unto me that they should not be used only in times of winter or of cold or of famine. Yeah, that's right. Mormons are supposed to be vegetarians.
And if you want to eat flesh or fail to eat flesh or however you want to do it, whatever your opinion on flesh is and vegetarianism and whatnot, maybe you're a Catholic and you'd like to explain it to us, we're actually going to be at the Mandarin Gate, as usual.
Come eat some flesh with us.
At 4:30. I'm going to be eating flesh. That sounds really appetizing.
That's what she said.
Yeah, I was waiting for that. 4:30, Mandarin Gate, 10,000 Aurora Avenue, just two blocks from Scan Studios. And if you come on and visit, we'll see you there.
Yes, although I won't be there because I have to go pick up a battery cell phone. Right. Anyway, cell phone battery. So I kind of makes me wonder, since the vegetarian thing has all obviously fallen by the wayside, if you know any Mormons, they are meat eaters. Trust me, Mormons eat meat all the time. I wonder if the strong drinks thing is actually going to be on its way out, especially now that the Mormon Church owns Coca-Cola Company. Anyway, in 1890, the church disavowed polygamy, even though most
of its... That's straight out of the Illuminati.
Even though most of its founding members, particularly Joseph Smith, practiced it. There are still sects of Mormonism that that practice polygamy, but they've been officially cut off from the main church and are considered fringe groups.
And then the crazies you hear about in the media.
Yes. The hemlines of temple garments, which a lot of people know as magical Mormon underwear, the hemlines have changed dramatically over the past 200 years in response to secular fashion trends.
I was hoping we could get through the show without mentioning the underwear, because the clothing is the least interesting thing about Mormonism. It's the Catholics.
I know, let me finish! Oh my God, we have like 2 minutes left! Shut up!
Okay.
In 1978, the church formally revoked the doctrine of the curse of Cain, scare quotes, which basically stated that black people were descendants of Cain, of Cain and Abel fame, because they came from a sinful line, and because they were descended from Cain, who was a bad guy, they couldn't hold the priesthood or worship in temples, and it was only in 1978 that was revoked. And finally, in 2005, certain practices that take place during the temple endowment ceremony were altered due to claims made by church members that the practices made them uncomfortable. They just basically involved touching a dab of oil to different parts of your body. But because
am I a Mormon now?
I think because of so many lawsuits facing the Catholic Church, Mormons decided it was probably a good idea to do away with that.
You can't throw the curse of Cain out there without letting me comment on it. I'm sorry. Seconds left.
Okay, go for it.
No, what? Pass.
Well, that's all. See y'all next time.
Yeah. Well, no. Seriously, though. I think we may have to drag this up.
Possibly.
Thanks for tuning in.